This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to The Country Hour this Friday. I'm Isabella Pittaway. From scorching temperatures to 70 mils of rain, the potato harvest has gone off to a bit of a difficult start for some growers, so could there be a spud shortage? You'll find out soon. Also this lunchtime, whether you celebrate it or not, it's the biggest day of the year for some florists and flower growers. It is, of course, Valentine's Day. Now, you might give someone a bunch of flowers, but would you also eat them? I'll take you to a flower farm that specialises in growing edible ones.
They get dried and have gone off as dried red rose petals to go into cocktails, and they've also going out today across the Sunshine Coast to cafes, and petals will be obviously on little plates around the place.
That story is coming up after the weather, but first today, farmers leasing agricultural land are set to become more common as land availability and costs continue to rise. A new Rabobank report found leasing land also offered farm operators ways to adopt a wider range of business models and ownership opportunities such as equity partnerships. Analyst and report author Wes Lefroy is speaking here with Jane McNaughton.
Traditionally, we've seen farmers across the country expand operations by buying the farm next door. And as a part of our research, we've been looking at alternative methods for expansion. And one of those methods was leasing. And amongst our research, we looked at the percentage of farmers that are leasing across the country on a state-by-state basis, also a production basis and a farm size basis. But we also looked into the reasons why farmers lease. And our key conclusion from our research was that we found the motives to lease Australian ag land are increasing. The main benefit for leasing is that opportunity to unlock access to scale. And we've seen an incredibly low number of properties on the market. In fact, we've recorded a decline in the number of properties on the market of up to 40 to 50% in all states across Australia. So from that perspective, the opportunities to buy are very low. We've seen that as a key reason why farmers should be turning to or considering leasing, but also the fact that it supports the diversification of business models, for example, sale and lease back as an example. But also we know that leasing can assist farmers to mitigate against weather risks. And certainly we've seen the increase in climate volatility as a key reason why farmers are considering managing weather risk in the future.
Are there any particular industries that are taking up land leasing more than others?
What we found was that the cropping production types led the way from a leasing perspective compared to the livestock production types. So for example, we found that 38% of grains farms across the country leased some portion of operated area. Now, that was much lower than beef farmers, for example, which were just above 20%. Now, the major reason for that we saw that it's much easier for crop farmers to unlock those economies of scale compared to beef farmers.
In your report, it says that it's more common to lease in South Australia and Western Australia. Why is that?
It does. And the major reason that we found that was because there was a higher concentration of grains farms, but also a higher concentration of large farms. So we found that 45% of farmers in South Australia lease some portion of operated area, and 38% in Western Australia. And that's compared to 17% in New South Wales, where there's a higher proportion of small livestock farmers located. So it was very much down to production type and also farm size.
Is this a good option for young people that want to, that say they're waiting for their dad to give over the family business? Is this a good option for young people who haven't got the money to not only buy the property, but then also, you know, the tractors? Is this a way to get young people in the door faster into long-term farming?
Absolutely. And one of the key reasons that we see leasing such an important consideration for farm growth strategies is the diversification of farm business models, and in particular around succession. So obviously for a young farmer wanting to expand their own operations, taking on a huge capital cost so early in their career can be extremely difficult. So leasing offers an option where they can work their way into the business and expand that over time, either with intentions to buy the property down the track or remain leasing for a longer period of time.
That was Rabobank analyst Wes Lefroy speaking there to Jane McNaughton. What's attracted you or put you off leasing land in South Australia? You can send me a text on 0467 922 891, or you can also call 1300 222 891. Now, as Wes said in that story, South Australia has the highest rate of land leasing. Rural real estate specialist agent for the Upper and Mid-Southeast, Jeff Watts, says while there isn't a lot of agricultural leasing in the Southeast compared to other parts of the state, the demand is there.
It would be good to know parties that are perhaps looking at the end of their farming career or wanting to go off and do other things could lease the property out to another younger player or another nearby landholder that are looking to expand a bit. They'll probably run it a bit better or certainly capitalise on its potential often more than what it currently is. Whereas the landholder still maintains their interest in the property, their investment in it, and still getting a reasonable rate of return.
Why aren't many farmers leasing in this region?
Yeah, just because I think they can make handy money elsewhere. Perhaps they don't trust people. Perhaps they can do it easy themselves. Certainly a lot more land leased in other areas where it's broad-scale cropping and lesser on livestock. It's just not a huge thing. It's getting a little bit more as we go along, but not a great deal.
Is there the demand for leased land, though?
Oh, absolutely. If we were to put up a block of land for lease by tender or registration of interest or whatever, you'd have 30 inquiries, easy peasy. And I did one only a year ago, and I think I had 16 inspections and 15 offers to lease the property, and ended up it was considerably more than all parties anticipated that we'll get on an annual return.
With agricultural properties, how much would people roughly be paying in rent compared to if they were to buy the place and pay a mortgage? What's the percentage difference?
Well, not much at all. Very, very similar, actually. I mean, a lot of rural land is leased out at values anywhere between 3 and 8%. The higher values as to perhaps where it's certainly a lot more higher capacity property and higher inputs, perhaps certainly not a lot at 8%, but some are. And a lot are roughly around the 4 or 5%. Now, a lot of people are going to be able to borrow the money at that rate or, you know, less than 5%. That's if they've got the borrowing capacity, and that the banks are seriously looking at the ability to service those loans more than ever than they have before. And a large amount of people, when they will make an offer to buy a property subject to finance, will, I suppose, 35, 40% of those contracts that I sign subject to finance do fail.
And are we seeing the leases more in small to medium-sized properties or those larger blocks?
Traditionally, smaller to medium properties, but there are opportunities out there, some cases across the state, for bigger operations and perhaps even dairy situations and stuff like that that are coming out available, where even parties will sell the property and then lease it back. Because certainly that sort of thing is starting to come about a bit more often, from, you know, a little 200 acres all the way to 5,000 acres sort of thing.
Now, farming tends to have a lot of overheads, and farmers do put a lot of money into the property before they get any returns, but they do have that asset of the property. When you're leasing, that's taken away. Does leasing also take away the risk?
Oh, no, I don't think so. The property holder, well, he's fine. He's got the property and he gets X, Y, Z return every year, depending on what the lease arrangement was on a per hectare or annual amount. The chap doing the leasing, well, yeah, he's got an annual rent repayment on the same token, and that's similar to the interest he would be paying otherwise. But then again, yeah, he's got all the machinery or livestock or those sorts of things. So it is a fair roll of the dice. In the land of milk and honey here, really, do we not come out the other end quite well. 19 out of 20 years, you generally will always reap a crop or cut bars of hay and shear sheep or sell off fine land. So I certainly there are some areas in the state that can't say that, that aren't as reliable.
And is leasing in this in the southeast going to be on the rise?
I think so, yeah, in time to come, I think so, because I think there's still plenty of landholders that just actually still would like to keep the land and still be attached to the land, and might realise that they could still have a nice little nest egg there and could lease it out with some reasonable terms to the tenants.
That was real estate agent Jeff Watts speaking there to Bridget Herman.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, it is a quarter past 12 and we're going to stay in the southeast because potato growers are just starting harvest, but unfortunately the recent rains have drowned some potatoes. In Mingbull, between Mount Gambier and Panola, farmer Terry Buckley says he's lost roughly 20 acres of potatoes to the wet weather. This is the latest in what he says has been a challenging year for farmers.
Very cold and rather windy in the springtime, so they got off to a rather slow start. The day of 46 point whatever it was, or 45 point whatever it was really nasty on them. And some of the crops up near Border Town, I think they got to 49 or 50 there, and they've died, some of those, early. And now we've just had nearly 70 millimetres of rain, which we've actually drowned some of our potatoes, so it's been pretty difficult.
Can you give me any idea of how many potatoes have been lost in the region?
We're probably in the most difficult spot, so we've lost maybe 20 acres of potatoes, I think, which should be 400 tonnes, which is, you know, considerable, but others have lost some. But it becomes very difficult to irrigate and continue your season because you've got bits that need irrigating and bits that don't need irrigating, and that's the way it goes.
And is this going to have an economic impact on the industry this year?
Oh, it's a bit of an ongoing thing with potato growing all around the world at the moment. Potatoes up along the river are certainly less than they were because the water up there got so expensive and hard to get that some people haven't planted their potatoes. And there's been serious issues with too hot and dry in Europe all through the summer. And then it's got too wet and they've drowned a lot of potatoes in England. And some of Germany, I think, has lost some. North America, Canada and USA, they've frosted and snowed under quite a lot of potatoes. They haven't been able to harvest. Just a sign of the times with the weather as it is.
And bringing it back to our local growers, will the recent rain have delayed harvest at all?
No, it probably actually brings harvest forward. We're now harvesting, but not in the paddocks that are particularly wet. But your crops tend to sort of die off a bit earlier after you've had wet like that. It's something to do with their mindset. Yeah, no, we're under full swing now and supplying most of the places that we send potatoes to.
And it sounds like there might be a bit of a potato shortage.
We'll wait and see, but I don't think anyone's talking surplus by any means, and I think it'll be enough or inclined to be short is the way I'm seeing it at the moment. Yeah, it depends how the season, you know, the next few weeks go and how the season finishes off a bit.
Mingbull potato grower Terry Buckley. Nearby farmer David Whitwer also had potatoes caught in the rains, but he says he has drains in some paddocks, which helped him avoid the worst of it.
We did lose some potatoes, but we put drains through our potatoes to counter those summer rains, so it gives you a bit more hope. Yeah, because every paddock is different, how much it handles rain. Yeah.
And you've got paddocks sort of on different blocks around the place, is that correct?
That's correct.
Do you need drains on all of them, or is it actually really quite a location-based thing?
Yeah, it is. You can't do it at all paddocks. Some with a bit undulating, and you just put drones joining the low spots up, and if you can run them out of the paddock, it works very well. It all takes a bit of time doing it, but when you sort of rains 2 inches and above, it sort of certainly helps.
What about around the Mingbull area? Is it undulating or is it actually quite flat?
It's a bit of both, to be honest. There is some undulating country there, but the flat areas you can't do much about. There is lower spots that you can run out sometimes, but a level paddock, you can't do anything about it.
Would you have been affected if you didn't have drains?
Yeah, definitely. Yep. Yeah, we would have lost a lot more, for sure. Our country, the clay's pretty close, so you haven't got a lot of leeway with watering. Because when it's hot, you've got to water pretty well, otherwise you lose buds. So it's a fine line. Yeah.
That was potato farmer David Whitwer there speaking to Bridget Herman. It is coming up to 20 past 12 on the Country Hour. And look, we've been talking about the coronavirus quite a bit, and there have been other massive viral outbreaks before. So why is it that the coronavirus outbreak is having such an impact on markets across the world? Wool analyst Andrew Woods says he hasn't seen the wool market this unpredictable since the 2008 financial crisis. He says while China's response to the outbreak makes sense to him, it's part of the reason why markets are so unstable.
Well, the big change for the coronavirus has been two others in the past 20 years, is the reaction by the Chinese administration to in their attempts to stop the spread of the virus. And in doing that, they're locking down big slabs of China, understandably, doing their best to stop the coronavirus from overwhelming their health systems. But in doing that, they're locking down a lot of supply chains, and wool is one of the industries that's involved. And by locking down the supply chains, it's just creating uncertainty because the various parts of the supply chain don't know if they're going to be able to deliver or receive components which go into or out of the Chinese part of the system.
But this doesn't always mean prices drop. In some cases, it's meant that they've risen recently, hasn't it?
Well, yes, but there is a residue of old orders floating around the system. But it would be reasonable to expect that it's mid-February, so the coronavirus will be causing a lot of uncertainty through March, perhaps into April, and then if things go well, it tones down then. So I think uncertainty just means prices can jump up and down quickly and without a lot of notice.
So you're saying the market might be very, very erratic for the next few months?
Yeah, yep, I think so. And a good example, though, if you look at last week, there were some good forward bids out to the middle of the year, and then this week they've disappeared. So that's just telling you how the people laying those forward bids are seeing the uncertainty. So last week was all right, this week it's not.
Can you think of the last time you would have seen the market this uncertain?
Well, for different reasons, so you got 28.8. 2008, 2009, that was a financial crash. So, yes, but for different reasons.
That's wool analyst Andrew Wood speaking there to Lucas Forbes. And now to a video that's brought a smile to many faces right across Australia. After getting some rain and newly green paddocks, Gyra sheep farmer Ben Jackson got his sheep to form the ABC logo. But just how did he do it? Here he is talking to ABC News Breakfast, Michael Rowland.
Most of last year, in fact, almost every day last year, we've been trail feeding sheep, which means whacking a bit of barley in the back of a truck and putting it out, going back and forth and back and forth. And, you know, you just got to put it out in some specific patterns and next thing you know, you're having a blast. You get the dogs, you know, Fluffy, Strudel and Weird Horse to muster them all up and they see the grain and next thing you know, you've got yourself a ABC worm logo thing.
The ABC worm logo thing, also known as the Lysajew, that is Gyra sheep farmer Ben Jackson. And if you haven't seen that incredible video, head on over to the ABC Rural Facebook page. I'm pretty sure it's also our banner photo now as well. Lots of love for it online. Karen saying it's amazing. Your dance was a fitting climax. Yes, there is a dance at the end of the video. Judith says, what a great ABC fan. And Paul saying, awesome to see some green grass over there. So head on to the ABC Rural Facebook page if you haven't seen it, or maybe you just want to rewatch it. I don't blame you. It is 24 past 12. Let's head off to the Weather Bureau now, and it's good afternoon to senior forecaster Mark Analak. Hey, Mark.
Hi, how are you going, Isabella?
Not too bad. It is a bit of a cooler day today, though.
It is.
generally the whole state is experiencing a milder south-south-easterly wind regime, giving us these cooler temperatures and certainly cloudy conditions across southern agricultural areas, producing a few little showers as well, drizzly showers onto the southern coasts. Currently, the synoptic pattern has a high-pressure system south of WA, and over the next 24 to 48 hours, we'll see that high-pressure system continue to move eastwards towards the Bight. As a result of that, the southerly winds will continue over South Australia, so milder conditions are expected to persist right through into the weekend. The cloudy conditions will also continue through the weekend and take some time before that high pressure system drifts off to the east, and we're probably looking at later on Sunday before it moves to a position south of Tasmania. And as it does move down southeastwards towards south of Tasmania, the winds will turn east-northeasterly, and we'll see just a bit of the sun popping out for the rest of the weekend. That's only for a short period, though, because there is another high-pressure system that's expected to push in south of the Bight early next week, and that'll bring these cooler southerly winds back to South Australia. So while Sunday looks like the pick of the days in the next few, with generally warmer conditions and sunny skies, come early next week, the winds will turn southerly, and we're back to cloudy conditions across agricultural areas. Maybe the odd light shower as well, pushing up onto the coast. But in total, we're not expecting too much in the way of rainfall. Tomorrow morning, yeah, some drizzly showers around on the southern, on the coastal fringes in the southern agricultural areas. Maybe into Sunday, but we'll probably have to wait until Tuesday before the next lot come along. And all in all, we're only looking at falls of less than a couple of millimetres. Maybe a bit more on the southern coast and the southeastern side of the Fleurieu Peninsula, where they might see a little bit more, but again, less than 5 millimetres, I would think. We do have a strong wind warning out for northern Spencer Gulf today. Those southerly winds funneling up through Spencer Gulf, could get a bit strong through the northern parts, north of about Wallaroo to Cowal, and we're looking at winds of 20 to 30 knots at times later this afternoon. So we do have a strong wind warning out for northern Spencer Gulf this afternoon. And then looking quickly ahead to the mid to latter part of next week, that second high pressure system I spoke about moving in will very slowly move eastwards, and we're looking at very stable conditions through next week, and I would expect very little change to the forecast through the mid to latter part of next week, remaining mild with south-easterly winds maybe turning easterly towards the end of next week. This has been Mark Analak at the Weather Bureau.
And Mark, before you go, a question without notice from the executive producer of this program. Cassie wanting to know, she heard that, the high humidity is the reason why the cyclone off the east coast won't make it across the Great Dividing Range. Can humidity do that?
Not quite, no. We have a trough of low pressure that's sort of hovering over the eastern states at the moment. And to the east of that trough, there's quite a bit of humidity. And that's, with the trough of low pressure over Victoria, the humidity is actually moving around south of Victoria and then back up onto the southern coast of South Australia in those southeasterly winds. The cyclone itself is a separate entity, and it did go over Lord Howe Island last night, and it produced a gust to 153 kilometres an hour that I know of. So it went right bang smack over the top of Lord Howe Island and is now making its way down to New Zealand, where it will sort of die a slow death, I think. So, but to answer your question, no, it's the humidity isn't responsible for the cyclone out there, no.
Okay, thanks for answering it. Love your work, Mark.
Okay, see ya.
Mark Analak at the Weather Bureau there. Let's look at the far west of New South Wales now. And for the Upper Western District, tomorrow is going to be a hot and mostly sunny day. A medium chance of showers in the southeast in the afternoon and a zero chance of rain elsewhere. Overnight, it's going to be between the low to mid-20s and then heading up to the mid to high 30s. For the Lower Western District, a mostly sunny day with a medium chance of showers in the far east in the afternoon. There will be a chance of a thunderstorm as well. And overnight dropping to between 17 and 22 degrees, and then during the day getting up to the low to mid 30s. Still to come on the Country Hour, we're going to be talking about mead, the world's oldest alcoholic drink.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Isabella Pittaway.
Hello. Great to be with you this Friday afternoon. Coming up this half hour, it's the biggest day of the year for flower growers and florists. It is, of course, Valentine's Day. I'm going to take you to a flower farm that specialises in edible blooms, and they've even had their flowers featured in a blockbuster movie. Plus, mead is considered the world's oldest alcoholic drink. And here in Australia, producers are trying to raise the profile of the honey beverage.
It's been the fastest growing segment of the alcohol industry in the States for the last 7 years straight, from a very low base level. And if Australia doesn't get on board with it, they'll sort of miss the boat, because people are just loving Australian products, Australian honey and Australian mead.
To join the conversation today, 0467 922 891. We also love taking your calls, 1300 222 891. It is just after 12:30. Claire Campbell has the latest in news headlines. Good afternoon, Claire.
Good afternoon, Isabella. Making news this afternoon, police have reported South Australian Liberal MP Sam DeLuc for basic assault over his alleged behaviour at a Christmas party. Mr DeLuc is accused of slapping SA Best MP Connie Benaris on the behind and making inappropriate comments to staffers at the event. The Federal Opposition has accused the Prime Minister of misleading Parliament over the sports grants scandal, with the Audit Office saying more than 40% of the projects were ineligible for funding by the time agreements were signed. The federal government has extended income assistance for people affected by the summer bushfires in the Coorong, Murray Bridge and Southern Mallee areas. The University of Canberra is making students stuck in China defer their studies for the semester due to the coronavirus travel restrictions. And in cricket, South Australia is fighting back from a poor start in its Sheffield Shield match against Western Australia at the Adelaide Oval. I'll be back at 1 o'clock with more ABC News.
Thanks, Claire. It's 28 minutes to one, and let's go to the Eyre Peninsula now, because Cowes Mayor is calling on the state government to help councils in drought-stricken areas keep businesses afloat by providing loans to cover their unpaid rates. The region is entering its third year of drought, with profits down for farmers and businesses. Mayor Robert Walsh says his council will go into debt if it doesn't recoup money it's owed by businesses in the town that are struggling to pay rates. But he says taking legal action feels unfair, given the circumstances.
Council rates have been an ongoing issue for quite a while, where people can't pay them. And usually we write them a letter first of all, and most people respond. And then if you find it difficult, you can go back on a payment scheme. Most farmers, it's just a cash flow issue, and they sort of wait till they can sell some wool or some grain and then do the final payment. Our rates are usually between 5 to 10% unpaid, and it's been like this for quite a while now, but it's really hard when someone can't pay the rates eventually that we have to act on it, and that's when we have to use legal advice to write a legal letter, and that is actually put on top of the rates. It makes it harder for a local to do this, because it's usually done to your friends and stuff. So if there was another way around it, just for like to have a moratorium for a short while where we don't have to act on payment of rates, just let it sit. But we run deficits, so we can't afford to hold that money. But if the state government could basically lend that money to us interest-free till we recover it, I think it'd be quite a good idea. And help small businesses out, because currently, if you're a primary producer, if you are eligible for household support, you get a 50% rate reduction, but it's not really any help there for people in private businesses. When you're in a small town, everybody knows everybody. It's just something I'd like to avoid, and doesn't really cost the government anything if they can actually just lend us the money so we don't have to act on it. It's because you will get your money back with rates. It always will, because if someone gets that far behind, the property is sold and recover rates. But why do it in this sort of times where there's no income coming in.
Are you seeing businesses pack up and leave town because of financial pressure?
We've seen in our oyster industry, yes. Some got virtually given away to do with the ponds. And businesses, your hotels struggle when people haven't got money, they struggle. They still get by, but boy, do they struggle. And because they have such a high value business, their council rates are extremely high. So I wouldn't mind betting sometimes the only bit of profit they've got at the end of the year has to be paid in rates. It's a fine line when we have seasons like this.
And are you concerned, I guess, as the mayor, that by pursuing some of these businesses that are struggling, that might force them out of town?
It definitely doesn't do them any good. You will get to a point where some people will put their arms up in the air and leave or sell, but I don't want to see that happen. We, like I said, anyone that wants to keep going, we do. We get them on a repayment plan, and that's the way, it's the only way they can if they haven't got the money, but we still don't get our money that way. And because my council runs deficits, I would like us to have that money. It's just so much easier to budget. In the end, we go in the deficit because somebody else is in deficit.
Have you approached the state government about this idea of providing loans to help cover unpaid rates for businesses that are struggling?
I think it has been thrown around a bit what else you can do for small businesses, because obviously we've just had the 50% subsidy for farmers who are eligible for support. They're getting something. But then small businesses, there hasn't been anything for them. So I just think it would be nice if there was just to show we care.
Franklin Harbour District Council Mayor Robert Walsh. The state government currently offers rate rebates for farmers eligible for farm household assistance. Treasurer Rob Lucas says he'll consider the mayor's request if he's given more detail about the gaps in support for businesses.
Well, we're certainly prepared to consider any request for assistance or support, but we'd need to see more detail on exactly what's being asked for. The advice I've been provided for example, is that the state government has already announced a 50% rebate on local government rates up to $7,500 for farmers who are eligible for a farm hold allowance already, and that the federal government has also announced drought loans of up to $2 million for primary producers and up to $500,000 for small agriculture-related businesses. So there is a range of assistance which is already made available by the state and federal government. So we would need to get more detail on what the mayor thinks is the gap in the level of assistance that's already being provided.
That is Treasurer Rob Lucas ending that story from Lucy Robinson. And as you might have heard in the news headlines, the Australian government has extended income assistance to people affected by the bushfires in South Australia in the local government areas of Coorong, Murray Bridge and the Southern Mallee. For more information on that or to make a claim, just visit humanservices.gov.au/disaster. Now, earlier we were talking about how farmers leasing agricultural land are set to become more common as land availability and costs continue to rise. Fred's texted in saying that lease prices in the mid-north and upper York Peninsula have increased dramatically to the point that it's almost unviable to lease land. Thanks for your text, Fred. You can join the conversation on 0467 922 891. Up next, we're off to a flower farm.
This week on Landline, meet the scientist who started work breeding sheep but helped create 10 million IVF babies.
It made a huge difference to them. These are people that could form their own families then.
And fancy a drink of non-alcoholic gin? That's Landline this Sunday, but please check your local guides for times, because the ABC is broadcasting the Australian Women's Open Golf Tournament.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
It's 22 minutes to one, and lovely to be in your company this Friday afternoon. And it is Valentine's Day, so you might have bought some flowers. We've had some flowers that have been delivered here to the studios as well this hour. And if you're buying a rose on Valentine's Day, chances are it's been imported, because in 2018, 6.4 million rose stems were flown into the country. Now, add to to that, the Department of Agriculture announced a review of biosecurity measures because a review found that less than half of imported flowers complied with environmental safeguards. Now, on the Sunshine Coast, a committed grower is struggling to meet demand for her certified chemical-free flowers, with delivery made a little more difficult by floodwaters this week. And they're not all for show. Kaz Owen specialises in edible flowers, and the creeks receded just in time for Jennifer Nichols to make a visit.
I'm drying out rose petals at the moment for a wedding celebrant who has a wedding today, so these will be thrown around, but as you can see, they're very, very rain-sodden. So I think we're past the 10 inches over the last week, and my husband's sadly, I think, replaced the driveway about twice, and we're very appreciative of the rain, but at the end of the day, yeah, we've certainly seen our fill for the, I think, for the year.
It's giving you some challenges.
Certainly is, absolutely, yes. Over the last couple of months, we went through drought, and now we have the flooding rains. We'll head up now, and we'll go and I'll show you the changes in the garden since you were last here.
These are my firefighter roses that I put in after the fires. Remember fire?
When well, you had it come so scarily close. Yeah,
so there's my firefighter roses and they're just coming on now. And the proceeds of those roses go to the CFA. They're our edible flowers, so we've got areas of just purely edible flowers. And
it's so gorgeous, Kaz. It's a bit wild, a bit like you.
Oh, look, I haven't been able to get near a whippersnipper for weeks, for months because of the rain. But what we're getting now is in between the rapidly growing weeds, in between the rose bushes, you've got the nasturtiums are just about to pop back through and the cosmos. So all the other little plantings that I have in the middle, they all sort of come back. Especially in dry conditions, you can't waste any area. So to have a pristine, you know, beautifully manicured garden, to me, is not productive and doesn't achieve anything. So underplanting is definitely part of what we do. But however, it self-seeds every year. So everything comes back naturally every year.
I just love it. There's geraniums and roses and rosemary.
Yeah, and the basil. The basil's the bee food, and you can see there, they're just covered in bees. And I'm getting more and more different types of bees every season. It's very, very interesting. The way it works here in southeast Queensland, with the drought, and because we're on tank water, the roses and the bushes actually start to go dormant. They don't die, but they stop producing. So just before this rain commenced, we were at critical stage, and then the rains came, so pretty much the gardens have kicked back into gear, and we're coming into that cooler change. It's just been magnificent. So like even for Valentine's Day, but just in general, the roses have been coming back into bloom magnificently. They love water, so they can't give them too much water as long as they've had good drainage.
So only too much for you.
Yeah, you can tell by the soggy boots.
So how many rose bushes have you got out there now?
Well, round about 4.5, probably coming into 5 acres of actual gardens, probably over 2,000 last count of the rose bushes.
Wow.
And then the edible flower gardens and the herb gardens. So it's quite extensive and quite prolific flowering on an ongoing basis.
Now, I know when it comes to Valentine's Day, the majority of the flowers that people are buying are imported, and they're a lot cheaper than the price you could do them at, especially since you're organic and you're growing outside, so you're growing with nature. How do you do in terms of demand?
Demand this year has been very challenging for a lot of the florist industry, because as a result of the drought, which then turned into fires, which also covered majority of our growing areas of Australia, we lost flower farms, we lost rose farms. So it has impacted on the Australian market, growers market, significantly. For people like me, the drought affected me. So my roses, to come out of drought conditions, even with the rain, can take up to 6 to 8 weeks. So pretty much for me, I've been able to not meet demand this year. So I've kept a few people very happy. But however, it's not the same Valentine's it would have been.
So you've been turning people away?
Yeah, sadly.
How many bunches would you have done for Valentine's Day, do you think?
For me, only a couple of dozen, because the majority, as you can see from the red roses, they go off and they're edible. They go Brisbane, they get dried and have gone off as dried red rose petals to go into cocktails, and they've also going out today across the Sunshine Coast to cafes, and petals will be obviously on little plates around the place.
That is Kaz Owens from Organica Floret, and her edible chemical-free flowers are actually quite famous. They made it into the superhero movie Aquaman, the scene where Amber Heard is chowing down on some red roses. So there you go, a bit of movie trivia for you this Friday. Now, Kelvin Trimper is the immediate past president of the World Federation of Rose Societies and a hobby grower at Greenwith in the northeastern suburbs. Good afternoon, Kelvin.
Good afternoon. It's Valentine's Day.
Thank you. It is the busiest day of the year for florists and for flower growers. What does the lead up to Valentine's Day look like for South Australian rose growers?
We had very prime.
Oh, Kelvin, we seem to have a funny phone line there. I might get you to maybe move. Oh, that is much better. Wonderful. What does the lead up look like?
We had trying conditions in spring, early summer. We had that 47 degree day, I think, on November the 21st or 2nd, followed by heat waves before Christmas. So that certainly affected the roses. Look, they're pretty tough and they've bounced back very, very well. And certainly in my garden, there's a beautiful flush of flowers at the moment. And I had no trouble going out and finding some lovely red roses for my wife this morning in the garden. So I was quite pleased about that.
Lovely. And we touched on earlier in the previous story the fact that many roses, though, are still imported. Why is that?
For two reasons. The first is the cost of labour in Australia compared with that in places like Kenya and Ecuador and now Vietnam, which produce a lot of cut flower roses. China's also coming onto the market in a very, very strong way.
Kelvin, sorry, I might have to get you to move again. We're having fun with this phone line.
Yeah.
Oh no, Kelvin, we might have to leave it there because it is a bit of a funny phone line. That is Kelvin Trimper, who is the immediate past president of the World Federation of Rose Societies, and he's also a hobby grower at Greenwith. And I was speaking to Kelvin a bit earlier, he was saying that he's got 2,000 rose bushes, so that seems like quite a bit even for a hobby grower. I think we're going to try one more time to bring Kelvin back. Hi, Kelvin.
Hi, is that working?
That is working. That is working. That is hopefully sounding much better and looking like your roses are doing well. I was just touching on the fact that you've got about 2,000 of them. Is that right?
Yes, I'm a what you call a big hobby rose grower. I've got about 2,000 roses in my garden.
And so what does it take to look after them?
Water. As the lady from the Gold Coast mentioned, roses do like water. So they need at least one good soak a week, and in a heat wave, probably a couple of good soaks a week. And then, of course, fertiliser on top of that. They're like us. We can't just live on water alone. So we need, food, and a rose needs food to get the best out of it. Recognising that an average rose bush in Adelaide can produce 6 lots of flowers per growing season, which compared with most other plants is 5 times more than other plants.
Right. And is there anything else really sort of distinctive about what we grow here in South Australia as opposed to other states?
I think if you wanted to grow roses anywhere in the world, Adelaide would be the place to grow it, not only because we have a long, hot, dry summer, but also our humidity is low. So like your previous conversation with the Gold Coast, we're fortunate here. We can virtually grow our roses organically simply because we don't have to spray them for fungal diseases.
Right. And you mentioned earlier as well about we did have that extreme heat last year. Would they sort of be enjoying the cooler temperatures now? You mentioned before how sturdy they can be.
Oh, certainly. Look, I think the weather we've had over the last couple of weeks and that beautiful rain we had, which we were all grateful for a couple of weeks ago, the roses certainly benefited from that. And if you drive around Adelaide's streets at the moment, you see some beautiful roses on display. And not only are they flowering now, they'll flower all the way through to June.
And also many, many country towns also choosing to have roses in their main streets as well. Before I let you go, Kelvin, do you have a favourite rose?
I do. And even though it's Valentine's Day and red is the symbol of love, my favourite rose is actually a yellow rose called Gold Bunny.
And why is that?
It just flowers continuously from September right through till June. It's very hardy. Always puts on a good show. You can pick it and bring a bunch inside. Only has a light perfume, but is just a good all-round performer and I think well-suited to our environment.
A sturdy, dependable rose.
Indeed.
Excellent. Kelvin, thanks so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
And that is Kelvin Trimper, who is the immediate past president of the World Federation of Rose Societies and also a hobby grower at Greenwith in the northeastern suburbs. And, of course, the Riverland, Renmark in particular, also famous for its roses with its annual Rose Festival. It's coming up to 9 minutes to 1.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Have you ever tried mead before? The newly formed Mead Australia Association is aiming to raise the profile of the world's oldest alcohol made from fermented honey. It's an important step for the emerging industry, which is hoping to follow in the footsteps of cider and craft beer. Jennifer Nichols spoke to President Andy Coates and Secretary Nicola Cleaver.
We're pretty passionate about growing the whole mead industry in Australia. Part of that is getting all the mead makers on board and all together and forming an association, which is happening and happened. We've had voting and set up. So we're now called Mead Australia, and I've been voted in as president of Mead Australia. So as if I'm not busy enough already, more things to worry about. And Nicola is actually the treasurer of Mead Australia.
Yes, I am.
So that's where we're at, and we're just wanting to really push forward on the politics of growing the industry as a whole, levelling the playing field a little bit with as far as grape wine's concerned. And making sure that all the mead makers are putting forward really good product and building an industry from the ground up. We're sort of modelling ourselves a little bit on Cider Australia. They sort of were where we're at now as far as legislation goes, because they're lumped in a fair bit with the wine industry. It's just the way it's gone, because the grape and wine industry was sort of the only thing, and the legislation and definitions evolved around that. But now there's slight differences, and the legislation becomes a little bit tricky to navigate when you're not a grape producer or wine producer as such. It's pretty clear with the taxation side of things, but then there's grants and things to help out other industries that we're a bit excluded from at this stage, and yeah, we just need a bit of a unified voice to bang on some tables and get it all happening. And it's been the fastest growing segment of the alcohol industry in the States for the last 7 years straight, from a very low base level. And if Australia doesn't get on board with it, they'll sort of miss the boat, because people are just loving Australian products, Australian honey and Australian mead. And you know, we've got people knocking on the door from Hong Kong. They just love it. And you know, it's a shame to miss out on those opportunities because of red tape.
What's been the biggest disadvantage in not having an association?
I think a lot of the disadvantage is because we're coming from a virtually an unknown source. So if I had a dollar for everyone who asked what's mead or what type of meat do you do at your meatery, I'd be retired. So, just growing that as an education to get people to realise what mead is, and having industry, realise what that is.
And before we go any further, for people who don't know what mead is, can you explain?
So mead is an alcoholic beverage, the oldest alcoholic beverage, made from using honey as your fermentable sugar. So for cider, you ferment apples. For wine, you ferment grapes. For beer, you ferment grains. For mead, you ferment honey. And then to that, you can have different styles of mead with fruits and spices and lots of different things like that.
That is Andy Coates and Nicola Cleaver speaking there to Jennifer Nichols about, really creating a national organisation to help mead producers and raise their profile to follow in some of the success we've seen through Australia Cider. Now, Parliament House has been overrun with trailblazing young Australians this week as part of the Haywire Youth Summit. Now, Haywire is all about telling the stories of young regional Australians, and each year the winners of the competition head to Canberra to develop ideas to improve the lives of young people across rural and regional Australia. One of the attendees was 16-year-old Taylor Dolling from Cleve Area School on the Eyre Peninsula, who won with her story about looking after orphan lambs through the drought. She's speaking here with Brooke Neindorf about how the summit went.
Oh, it's been amazing. I've loved the experience. I was very nervous to come at the start, but it's definitely been worth it. I've loved meeting everyone and making new friendships and stuff.
What's been the best part so far?
Probably meeting everyone and hearing their stories. Like, we've heard them all on radio, but it's been so different hearing them in person and the actual story behind it.
Now, Taylor, your story was about the drought and having to feed orphan lambs. How have people responded to your story?
So we, at the start, we all shared our stories, and then we got the opportunity to come up with some things that are personal to us that we could get into groups and then come up with a project. So I'm with a farming group, and we came up with a idea around farming, which was good. So there's three of us in the group.
And so they had so they had similar stories to yours?
We all come from farming backgrounds.
So tell us about the project. This is obviously one that this is obviously a thing that happens every year at Haywire, where you get together in smaller groups and come up with an idea of something that might be able to be implemented in a rural and regional area. Tell us about your idea.
So our problem we came up with was the lack of understanding of people not knowing the process behind the food getting from paddocks to people's plates, and also the lack of recognising what farmers do and how much effort is put into it.
And so what solution did you come up with?
Yep, so the solution we came up with was having a farmer day in mostly in schools where some students, primary school students, come to school just as a farmer to show and support farmers in their communities, and also to get farmers into schools to talk about their personal experiences on a farm and to explain that process of farming and how much effort they do put in. And to make it easier for farmers to come into school, we came up with the idea of providing a resource pack for them. So it's all there ready to go for them, and all they have to do is rock up, and there'll be activities and stuff and videos provided in this pack.
And so is it something that they would look at going into maybe rural schools, or could it expand into to city schools as well?
Hopefully expand into city schools, as most kids from the city and people don't quite understand the process. So, like, one of our examples was kids not knowing, saying that eggs come from a carton and that milks come from the fridge, whereas there's a lot more behind it than that.
How did the presentation go? Do you feel like it all went well?
Yeah, so we presented this morning, and it feels great to know that it's done and out of the way. We had people come up to us and say that it was really well presented, so it was so exciting. Feels like a weight off my shoulders now that it's done.
What were some of the other ideas that come from the Haywire Week?
So another idea was racism and stuff in schools. So their idea was to have a hashtag to support different people and stuff. And there was also a climate change group. Yeah, a few others. There were six groups in total.
That is Taylor Dolling from Cleve speaking there with Brooke Neindorf. Sonia Feldoff is on your radio after one. Hi, Sonia, what's happening?
Hello, Isabella. Well, today is a Producers Challenge Day, so the challenge is going out right now. If you've thought of a topic or an issue you'd like to know more about, we throw it all into the mix, and those that get chosen, our producers have to get the answers to that just over an hour. That's all they've got. They're working against the clock to do it. So make sure you ring in and put forward your suggestions. Disturbing, I think, to see that in the case of the assault in the city this week, the teenage assault, and in the death yesterday on the motorbike, the initial response was to get out a film, your phone and film it. So what's changing in our brains that means that that's the automatic response in many instances rather than help? We're going to explore that change this afternoon as well.
Okay, thanks, Sonia. And thank you for your company this week. It is coming up to news time, 1 o'clock. Have a safe and happy weekend.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.